Just set a price. Tell me the price. Don't punish me for going at a certain time.
If you used rideshare apps, you know you can end up paying more at especially busy times of day or night. But would you pay more for a Frosty on a sweltering hot day?
2-day singles.
How much would it cost?
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Reports that Wendy's was considering surge pricing drew outrage earlier this year as consumers continue to seethe over shrinkflation and smaller product sizes.
Burger backlash from coast to coast.
So a burger may cost a dollar more during the lunch rush and $40 more at 3 a.m. We know you want it.
Today, we're going to talk about surge pricing, dynamic pricing, shrinkflation, and skimpflation, and what all this means for us and our wallets. Joining me in this recorded interview are Xavier University Assistant Professor of Marketing, Brian Buechner. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Thanks, Lucy.
And NerdWallet Data Analyst, Elizabeth Renter. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Elizabeth, the CEO of Wendy's talked about potential changes in the chain's pricing starting in 2025, and reaction was swift. Why do you think that was?
I think people are especially sensitive to all talk about prices right now. I mean, we've underwent extreme price increases under recent inflation. And so everybody's talking about prices. It's about as ubiquitous as the weather. We can all relate and complain about it together. And so I think the reaction was pretty swift and severe.
Brian, how did Wendy's competitors take advantage of that reaction?
I think one of the ways that they took advantage was reminding their consumers, one, that their prices are steady, right? They're not varying as much, but also competing on cost is pretty common in the QSR space. So reminding consumers not only are they constant, but they're cheaper as well, or a better value.
Yeah. And QSR, is that quick service restaurant?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I thought I knew, but I wasn't. I wanted to check. Elizabeth, Wendy's quickly said people misunderstood, that their plan was about saving customers money. What do you think? Was this a misunderstanding or a change in approach because of this backlash?
Well, executives mentioned the dynamic pricing in an investor call in February, and at no time did they mention surge pricing. They didn't provide a whole lot of context in that investor call. So I don't know if it was planned that they would discuss it or not, but they didn't say prices were going to increase on the call. And so it could have been a misunderstanding. Again, people are extra sensitive to talk about pricing right now. So entirely possible the masses just heard what they thought they heard and went with it.
Sure. Brian, talk about the difference between surge pricing and dynamic pricing.
Sure. So surge pricing is a little easier to understand because it's just like what it sounds, right? There's a surge in the price, especially when the demand is high. So like Elizabeth said, consumers are really sensitive to that. So think about Uber late night or airline fares during the holidays, during busy season, right? When demand goes up, the price goes up. The challenge with surge pricing is that the demand is what's driving it, not necessarily a change in value, which is where dynamic pricing differs. So I always like to use the example of sports with dynamic pricing, right? If the Reds are playing really well, they have a big game upcoming with a good opponent, it's probably going to be a better experience. So raising the prices doesn't bother consumers as much because they know what they're paying for is going to result in a better value than otherwise. So the surge pricing is really where you get into an issue where the price just spikes and consumers really aren't prepared and they're not actually getting a better value out of it.
Mm. And some industries have been using dynamic pricing for years, right? Talk us through that. You mentioned sports, but are there others that have typically used dynamic pricing?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, dynamic pricing has been around for a long time. Like I said, I think sports is one of the best examples. Other entertainment spaces, right, with concert tickets or even travel and leisure and places where you can offer more for what you're paying during certain times or to get better experiences is pretty common as well.
Mm-hmm. We're talking in this recorded interview about surge pricing, dynamic pricing, shrinkflation, and skimpflation, and what all this means for us and our wallets. Elizabeth, when do consumers tend to find these strategies more acceptable and less acceptable?
That's a great question. There is some evidence that people are a little more resistant to it when it comes to food. And that makes sense. You know, we need food to survive, but fast food is a luxury, right? One good thing about dynamic pricing is it encourages competition. So if Wendy's or anywhere else for that matter, increases prices at a certain time of day. I might choose a different menu item. I might choose to go to a competitor, but Wendy's is also very conscious that I might choose not to come back. In that way, competition is increased and it can work in favor of the consumer because it goes the other direction too. If Wendy's is offering discounts in the afternoon, Burger King ears might pick up and they may need to do something similar to help keep the customers they have.
And Brian, you referenced this a little bit earlier, but explain the difference between the price of an item and what it's worth, that kind of value proposition, and a little bit more about how that figures into all of this.
Sure. So from a consumer psychology standpoint, we as consumers tend to use price in two ways. One is an information cue. It tells us something about the product, whether that's the value or how much we're going to get out of something, but also a measure of sacrifice. We're giving up something. In this sense, it's usually economic to get something back. And so when we're evaluating price, we're sensitive to those two things and thinking about how can I get the most bang for my buck, right? We hear that all the time. And so when we're comparing prices, those are some of the things that we're thinking about. When it comes to value, however, it's really important for companies to have a really clear value proposition. And this is especially relevant in the food space where there is a lot of competition, like Elizabeth mentioned. So it's not just that the value is the lowest price. It might be something different. So for example, Burger King always tells you can have it your way, right? That's something that's outside of price. It's a little clearer and reaffirms that value that you're getting when you're seeing a certain price and making a purchase.
And so for maybe a fancier restaurant, if they're the only ones that have X, Y, and Z, you might go there because that's the only place you're going to be able to get the good stuff.
Sure, right. And it could also be something related to service. You know, the service that you get, the customer service is really important as well. It could be a unique experience that you get out of it as well. In these industries where there's a lot of competition, a lot of the times it goes beyond the physical thing you're getting. And there are a lot of other intangible things that you might be evaluating when you're looking at price in terms of deciding what kind of value you're going to get.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, do you think we're going to see more businesses use these types of pricing strategies, or is it more likely that more businesses will kind of try out this dynamic pricing in particular?
Yeah, I do believe that's the case. And part of the reason for that is technology is making it easier, right? In economics, there's a concept known as menu costs. And it originated in the restaurant industry where changing prices is costly because you have to print new menus. Well, menu costs kind of applies more broadly now. It's all of the costs associated with conveying price changes, making price changes, and dealing with the potential fallout of those price changes. Well, technology has made all of that a bit easier. And QR codes at restaurants is a great example of this. You know, a lot of restaurants switched QR codes during the pandemic, but it really reduced the friction and the costs associated with changing prices. So as technology increases, it gets better, it gets less expensive. I do believe we'll see more frequent price changes and dynamic pricing.
Brian, what do you think about those QR codes? I remember when that change happened and it was so, you know, we didn't all have to touch the same germy menus. That was part of it. But it does make it easier for businesses to make these switches without necessarily incurring the costs of printing new menus and also without necessarily alerting their customers quite as directly, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And one thing that Elizabeth said that I think is really important here is the friction, right? Frictionless is the key when you're doing any of these changes with technology. We're trying to make the experience for the consumer from the time they walk in to the time they walk out as easy and frictionless as possible. So the QR code certainly helps there, where you can not only browse the entire menu, but maybe do so more at your leisure. Some places might even have it integrated. So once you browse, you can also order on your phone or your mobile device as well. And so all of these efforts are trying to make that experience more frictionless. It's not always perfect, right? Technology has quirks. There are hurdles. Some places are more equipped to tackle it than others. But on the whole, I think when you see places like Wendy's kind of taking the charge in innovation, you see a lot of places maybe sit and wait and watch and kind of let them figure those bumps and bruises out and then roll it out themselves, which is why we see QR codes now are so much more ubiquitous than maybe they were just a couple years ago.
Yeah. I imagine there can be a lot of user error too. I know I've sat in a restaurant thinking I ordered from the QR code waiting for my food and I didn't press the right button.
Yeah,
so
certainly.
That's on me. How will AI be used to help other types of businesses use this kind of dynamic pricing, Brian?
So I think of AI in the sense of it from a consumer perspective, we feel like it is now everywhere. It can do certain jobs and tasks and things. And that growth has been very, very exponential, right? It's happened very quickly. And I think from a business standpoint, a lot of businesses are starting to wade into the waters, whether they really know what they're doing with it or not, to learn by doing and figure it out as they go. But I think with AI, what'll help with things like dynamic pricing especially is it's more accurate in predicting and identifying, you know, when prices should change and what they should change to. It's much more responsive to consumer data. A lot of places, retailers, restaurants, whatever it may be, they're collecting a lot of consumer data today, right? Because we scan a QR code on our phone, for instance. But the human part of digesting all of that data and making sense of it is really time consuming. It's really laborious. AI simplifies that in a lot of ways. So I think the places that find out not just how to use AI, but to use it well, are really going to start to gain an advantage in the marketplace because it's better predictive and it's making their lives and the consumer's lives easier.
And it sounds like that goes beyond restaurants. There are all kinds of businesses that could do that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we're going to continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our recorded interview about surge pricing, dynamic pricing, shrinkflation, and skimpflation, and what all this means for us and our wallets. My guests are Xavier University Assistant Professor of Marketing, Brian Buechner, and NerdWallet Data Analyst, Elizabeth Renter. Brian, are there businesses where this kind of pricing strategy, this dynamic pricing in particular, could actually help reduce waste? And I'm thinking of restaurants where fresh food can spoil if it's not used. Even grocery stores, when the milk's about to hit that magic date that you can see it marked down. How can it help in that regard?
On the business side, I think the examples you laid out there are clear where businesses are seeing an opportunity to reduce waste, limit their inventory, right, get things off the shelves. But what's important to remember from a consumer standpoint is that not all discounts are created equal. So, you know, getting a discount on something that maybe is shelf stable. So a dollar for Kraft mac and cheese versus two might seem more appealing than half price sushi, right? That's a couple days old or it's going to spoil. And so from a business standpoint, it's not always clear to just discount everything, right, to get it out the door. The consumers are sensitive to those things, but they're always receptive if it's something where they see that the discount is actually benefiting them and it's not a reflection of the product quality or something's wrong with it.
Yeah. Boy, discount sushi, that's a really good example. Elizabeth, we've been hearing a lot of complaints about shrinkflation. What is shrinkflation?
Good question. This, instead of manipulating prices to sort of influence demand, now we're talking about influencing supply from the business side of things, right? So maybe I want to meet consumer demand where it is, and so I'm going to change my product, right? I can minimize price fluctuations in this way. Maybe if I'm a baker and the price of flour rises, I could use a different recipe. I could use cheaper ingredients. I could also make smaller loaves of bread. And so we're seeing this a lot in grocery stores and products where packages are getting smaller and smaller.
That's something even the president talked about during his State of the Union address, right? How big a deal is that for consumers, Brian?
I think today, especially, it's a bigger deal because we have access to so much more information. So we might not notice it on the shelf, but we might see it on Reddit or TikTok or somewhere, right? We might hear about it secondhand through other consumers. And so I think it's a bigger deal today, especially feeling the economic pressures that a lot of consumers are feeling. They want their dollar to go further. And when they're getting packages that are smaller than they're used to or paying the same for less, then that kind of raises the alarm, right? And makes them more conscious of what they're spending on, but also it can lead to frustration or switching to other products or reduce brand loyalty, all of the things that, you know, manufacturers, companies want to avoid.
Yeah. Elizabeth just talked about using cheaper ingredients or cheaper materials too. Is that what people talk about when they're talking about skimpflation, Brian? Tell us about skimpflation.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's finding ways to essentially reduce the cost of production to then increase profit margins by maintaining the same cost. And sometimes that might be a benefit, right? We see a lot of companies that are maybe moving to simpler packaging or more sustainable packaging, so they're reducing their packaging costs. Consumers also like that because the packaging is better. But when you get into things like maybe ingredients, or you're changing the makeup of a product, it tastes different, it doesn't taste as good, then you run into some issues in terms of consumer receptivity to those changes.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, are shrinkflation and skimpflation becoming more common or less common? Or are we just more tightly wound about it these days?
Yeah, I don't think these phenomena are new. I do think it's our awareness that has definitely increased. Again, we're very, very sensitive to how far our money is going now. We're all experiencing price increases. We're all experiencing shrinkflation to one degree or another, but we are more aware of it now. And also, I don't think this sort of like, even though the awareness is bigger now, I don't think the anger or outrage over higher prices and smaller products is new, right? We have to keep in mind adults now, this most recent spate of inflation is probably the only one they've encountered for many people. The last time inflation was really high was the early 80s, and many folks weren't paying their own bills at that time. So this is a new experience for many people, even if it's not a new one.
Brian, I think you're the one who referenced kind of TikTok and social media before. Is that what is highlighting this so much? I mean, these practices, as Elizabeth said, aren't brand new, but people are maybe encountering them for the first time, and then they can broadcast their frustration to the world. Is that feeding into all this?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. I mean, when I think of even my own behaviors as a consumer, right, I'm making decisions, buying groceries for the family. One of the things I usually don't pay a lot of attention to is the quantity or the weight or something, especially on products that I don't really think a lot about the weight, right? I think about milk in terms of a gallon. I think about cereal in terms of a box. So when I'm looking at those things on the shelf, or even worse, if I'm shopping online and I can't see it, that change in size really isn't super salient to me. But the price is, right? So if I'm seeing the price is stable, I might not even notice the change in size unless it's really noticeable. But if I see that other consumers have seen the same product and they are calling it out for me, then all of a sudden it's brought to my attention. So I think that that's a big part of it, because otherwise we're focused on maybe just price. And if price is staying the same, we might not even notice that the packages or the product is changing or getting smaller.
You just mentioned pricing, shopping online. And I think that's such a great point because you heard a lot of people complaining in the early months of the pandemic that they'd order something online and they were tricked. It was much smaller than they thought it was. It was different. It was, you know, all these different things. But it can be really hard to tell on some of these sites the quantity that you're getting. You know, if you can't look at it, hold it. Mm-hmm. Is that feeding into consumer frustration, you think, Brian?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. And earlier in this conversation, we talked about friction and reducing friction. And when you're shopping online, a lot of retailers' goal is just that. And so it might be that the information you're seeing, the decisions you're having to make are simplified, right? You think about Amazon, you can buy with one click. You see something, you click it, and it's at your door, right? And so we might be a little less deliberate when we're making those decisions. We might be a little less in tune to the other factors that influence the decision besides price. And so as a result, when we are shopping online, because it is more frictionless, we might be more susceptible to these things like shrinkflation.
Elizabeth, you've talked about how, you know, this is the first time some consumers are paying their own bills, have experienced this inflation. Do you think consumers in general have become more price conscious, or have we always resented these strategies and just haven't been able to broadcast our anger as easily?
Yeah, I think the modes for us to share our outrage have changed, right? I do know in the 1960s and 70s, people were on the streets with picket signs protesting high grocery and gas prices. So the outrage, like I said, is nothing new. It's how we communicate that outrage. And the messaging is far more widespread now. So I can be in your living room on your phone instantaneously talking about how upset I am with how high prices or smaller packages. And we just didn't have that communication decades ago when we last experienced high inflation.
Brian, some of these shrinkflation strategies especially are harder to detect than others. I'm thinking about, you know, a carved out bottom in a peanut butter jar, or your soap's in a package and you don't know until you open it that the shape has changed and it's a little bit smaller. How much do companies think about that before making these decisions about how to change products to make them more profitable?
Yeah, I think there's a decent amount of thought that goes into it because consumers are perceptive of change to a degree, right? If it's a major change, it's extremely obvious to us, right? But if it's a smaller change, it might fall outside of our line of sight, right? We might not notice. And so for some companies, they may even go through a whole rebrand where the product packaging changes and they're trying to draw your attention to something that's new while not maybe calling your attention to, hey, the price is the same, but the size has changed, mm-hmm. right? So I think there is a lot of thought that goes into it, not just from the manufacturing and like the creation side, but also on the marketing side, the branding side as well, to try to keep customers engaged, to try to keep them loyal, especially, but also being cautious that they don't draw too much attention to maybe that the product has gotten smaller.
Yeah, kind of look over here, look over here, not look over there.
Sure.
Do you think consumers are more understanding when economic times are tough and they realize businesses are struggling too, and then maybe less understanding when things get better but the prices don't go down and they feel like, oh, companies are just maximizing their profits kind of off my back? Do you think that feeds into some of this, Brian?
Yeah, I think so. And perception really is reality a lot of the times for consumers. In the past couple of years, too, as consumers, we've gotten our attention drawn to things that maybe we never thought about, like the supply chain, right? A product going from point A all the way to the grocery store shelf. And as we become more knowledgeable of those things, we might become more critical as well about how companies are pursuing them, not always having a full understanding of how they're actually trying to navigate them. Sometimes things are scarce because they're scarce, right? They're harder to produce. They might be smaller because they are just now smaller. But a lot of those things get kind of confounded. And especially like you mentioned, if we're feeling other pressures externally, we might roll those into our anger and frustration as well and mistake the feelings of broader economic trends for, you know, a specific purchase instance.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, how can people raise their own awareness of these issues? What should people be looking for? I'm wondering, can social media reviews help consumers make smarter decisions? Kind of checking out comments from other consumers, seeing how people have rated products, what they're thinking.
Absolutely. So I do think social media serves a good purpose in many cases, right? It does sort of make us aware that these things are going on. It can prevent us from ordering that thing that's 30% smaller, but we otherwise wouldn't have noticed. So yes, reviews. But we do know that sometimes not all of the reviews are completely on the up and up, right? Maybe retailers are paying for some reviews, or a social media influencer has a sponsorship. And so it does make sense to get your information from multiple sources, from trustworthy websites, in addition to social media, sort of double check the information that you're getting from places.
Do you agree with that, Brian? Any other tips?
No, I agree with that. The only other thing that I would add is to maybe take a second to also think what really matters to you, right? It is maybe switching brands to save the 10 cents worth maybe the trouble that comes with it, or changing from a brand, you know, you've really enjoyed, instead of just immediately kind of having that knee-jerk reaction. So really also kind of evaluating your own purchase habits, thinking about what really is valuable to you when you're making that decision as well. Yeah.
Well, I've been talking with Xavier University Assistant Professor of Marketing, Brian Buechner, and NerdWallet Data Analyst, Elizabeth Renter. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Lucy May.